don't think that this is just about death and dying. This is about protecting and empowerment and choice. Planning now is crucially important. Who's taking care of you while you're living? That's right. What planning to do. Yeah. I don't care. I mean, I do care what happens to my stuff after I'm gone, but while I'm living is what's most important to me. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I've seen it in my own family time and time again. You know, I lost my mom when I was 8 years old and there was nothing good in place. And we ended up with my dad, who probably shouldn't have gotten us. People don't fail to create wills because they don't know they should. They fail because they get caught in this intersection of psychology, mortality, family dynamics, and just general procrastination.
Hello, my fellow teenagers. Today, we're tackling something that touches every single one of us, and that's estate planning. Estate planning sounds complicated, maybe even a little intimidating, or like something you can put off until later. But here's the truth. If you don't have a plan in place, the state has one for you, and it may not be the plan you would have chosen. Without the right documents, your family can be left confused, overwhelmed, and tangled up in court at the very moment they're grieving and need clarity the most. Here's a statistic that says it all. Roughly 76% of Americans know that having a will is important, and yet only about 27% of us actually have one in place. Today, we're gonna close that gap. And there's no one I'd rather have guiding us through it than my guest, Sue Hunt. Sue is an estate planning attorney and the founder of Focus Estate Solutions in Greensboro, North Carolina. She has spent 3 decades helping families protect what matters most. Her expertise runs deep across family protection, wealth preservation, and elder law. And she has a real gift for taking that confusing maze of legal decisions and making it clear, personal, and even reassuring. So whether you're just getting started or you've been meaning to update your documents for years, today's conversation is for you. Wills, trusts, powers of attorney, protecting your home and your assets, and how to actually get it done. This really is everything you need to know about estate planning. Welcome to the Keen on Aging podcast. I'm Dr. Corinne Allman, and each week I sit down with experts and people living later life with purpose to share honest conversations and practical insights you can use to live this chapter of life on your own terms. So we're gonna jump right in, and I wanna ask you, what happens to my estate if I die without a will?
I love it. There is a plan. So if you die without a will, it goes by intestate succession. And that simply means that there's a estate priority as to how things are distributed. So it depends on whether you're married, whether you have children, whether your parents are living. So they're all different pieces and parts of it to determine where it goes. It doesn't necessarily just go to the state, but sometimes that can happen. I actually ran into that recently. My dad passed away 6 years ago, and he didn't really have anything that we were aware of. He died in another state, and so no estate was opened. And there, it turned out, I just found a couple of weeks ago, there was about $300 that went to the state because it was like refunds on things like that. And so there was no one to claim it. But in general, it's going to trickle down to family members. It doesn't just disappear.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
But nobody really wants their money going back to the state.
No, nobody does.
So what's the worst case scenario if you don't do estate planning? Like when you have worked with families or who have not done this, what are some of the pitfalls or the things that you've seen happen?
Yeah, you know, one of the saddest ones is when they haven't done any planning and one becomes incapacitated or incompetent. And, you know, we had some situations over the years where that's happened. And so they got a diagnosis maybe quite some time ago of early onset dementia, and they put it off and put it off. And I think people get scared of, you know, one, of the diagnosis and what that means. But there's also a, let's, you know, stick my head in the sand and not deal with it. And so in that scenario, they hadn't even done basic powers of attorney, which is part of estate planning. And so without a power of attorney, the spouse couldn't handle anything for them. They couldn't handle the banking. And then, you know, in a worst case scenario, let's say the husband has a house in his individual name that they've lived in for 20 years, but they never retitled it as spouses, and he gets dementia. The wife can't do anything with that property. She can't change title. She can't do anything unless she gets guardianship and then gets court permission to be able to do things. So for me, that's, you know, what the worst case scenarios are when we're still living and we haven't made a plan. From a, you know, what happens after we're gone, worst case scenario is that there's not clarity on who things go to. The family members get into fights over one, who's going to be in charge, but also who's going to get what.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to back up just to make sure our audience understands. You talked about a healthcare power of attorney and a financial power of attorney. Tell us what those documents are and kind of why they're important.
A power of attorney, general durable power of attorney, is a document that enables someone to handle all of your legal and financial matters for you if you don't want to or if you can't. So if you become incapacitated, you've decided who you want to make those decisions for you. And you usually have backups. Well, you should have backups. A lot of times people don't. They only name their spouse and then that thing fails. But the power of attorney enables them to pay bills and file taxes and manage your real estate and make decisions about how your finances are going to be managed for you. It's for you. A healthcare power of attorney is a medical directive that enables someone to make your medical decisions for you if you're unable to do that on your own. And generally, hospitals will rely on a spouse or, you know, maybe another family member, and not always. I mean, if there's conflict among family members or the person that they're relying on is not the person that you wanted. So with a healthcare power of attorney, you get to pick who you want to make your medical decisions for you if you can't. And then that enables them to speak with doctors, get your medical records. And there's also a provision in it where you can make your end-of-life decisions. So what your wishes are regarding life support and hydration and nutrition and, you know, organ donation and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah. And so when people don't have this, that's when the guardianship piece comes into play, because guardianship is the remedy if you haven't done your powers of attorney.
Correct.
Yeah. Everyone should have a healthcare power of attorney and a financial power of attorney, right? Or is this something that I only need when I become an older adult?
Not an older, well, it depends on what older is. When you become an adult, so 18 years old, you're an adult. Your parents aren't in charge anymore. And a lot of parents don't think about that as they're sending their kids off to school, to college. They don't have the right to get their school records or know about their medical decisions and things that are going on. And so I have a young adult plan that we bring kids in. You and I have talked about these before, that the child, you know, the 18-year-old, the young adult will come in and tell us who they want to appoint. It's usually their parents. At it on occasion where it's not, but they get to choose who they want to be able to make those decisions and be involved in their lives moving forward. And it's really important, especially going off to school. I mean, so many crazy things happen with these kids in school, and then the parents want to be able to stay involved and continue to have that ability to make decisions for them.
Yeah. Side note, Sue is currently supposed to be meeting with my daughter, who just turned 18 and needs to do these documents. And so far, my daughter has not made her appointment, but we're gonna rectify that. Yeah. So we practice what we preach around here in terms of everyone should have a healthcare power of attorney. It is not, and a financial power of attorney. Like, so many people that I run into, you know, we're talking about it with families and they're like, oh yeah, we'll do it when it's time.
Right.
And the time was like when you turned 18, that it was yesterday. It's not when something bad happens or when you get a diagnosis. Like, Don't wait until it's too late. Don't wait until you actually need it.
Right.
Put it in place way beforehand so that it's there.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Sophia, you know, your daughter is the perfect example of what happens, that, you know, I have all the time in the world. I'll get to it down the road someday. No, the someday is right now. We don't know what tomorrow brings. It's so important to get it done.
Yeah. She'll be seeing you before she leaves for college.
I'm sure she will.
Or there will be consequences one way or the other.
Yeah.
So tell us, I hear a lot of people talk about, I don't really need a will. What I need is a trust. Uh-huh. Or other people saying, no, you don't need a trust. All you need is a will. Can you kind of explain to us what the differences are between those two things and why you might want one or the other?
Yeah, so I kind of laugh when you're saying that, because I hear a lot, even after I've met with a client the first time, well, my hairdresser said that I really don't need a trust. And, or, you know, I went to DMV to take care of this and they told me I don't want to do this. And it boggles my mind that anyone would actually pause and think about, wait, is my attorney telling me wrong and my hairdresser is right? Or the clerk at DMV is right about this? I just got sidetracked on that.
That's okay. Do not listen to your hairdresser. Listen to your attorney. Yeah. Yes.
So the, you know, part of what we do in planning is educate clients on the difference between them. What is a will? What is a trust? So that when they're making a decision about their plan, they're doing it from an educated standpoint. I don't believe anyone should ever walk into an attorney's office and they just get a will or they just get a trust, because the attorney said that that's what they do. They should be getting it because it's what makes sense to them under their family dynamics, their circumstances, you know, all sorts of different pieces of it. And choosing it, the primary difference between them is probate versus no probate. So if you have a will, all of the assets that you own that don't have a beneficiary designation or aren't jointly owned with right of survivorship go through probate. If you have a trust and it's done right, and that means that things actually got into the trust, it got funded, your trust was funded, that means now the trust owns potentially your, and you're the owner of the trust, so it's not like you lose control, but the trust holds the real estate, the vehicle, the personal property, beneficiary designations, brokerage accounts, and you're continuing to manage it for your lifetime, but at your death, it's already contained in here, almost like you set up a little business that you're in control of. And then at death, you're just handing it off. Or I like to call it like it's a treasure chest that you're just handing over the chest with the treasure map and the key, and, you know, to a specific person that you've identified that's now going to handle this without having to go through the court process of probate, which is not fun.
So is there some sort of marker that tells us, or some sort of, what's your measuring stick to decide when people need a trust versus a will?
It's really not my measuring stick. There are a lot of folks who have come in that I would have said, just do, actually I have said, you can just do a will. And they're like, no, I really want to make this as easy as possible. So the measuring stick is ease.
Okay.
What is the goal of the client? Is the focus, I just want to make sure it's going to go where I want it to go? Or is it, I want to make this as absolutely simple as possible for my family or whoever I'm leaving things to or putting in charge of this? And then that is the measuring guideline. So you want to make it as simple as possible. It will almost always be a trust.
Okay.
If you say, I'm okay if they have to do a little work for this, they can hire somebody on the back end. You know, they can pay for it not out of my pocket while I'm living. They can pay for it out of what's left for them on the back end, then they can do a will. But it's not there are times when I say someone absolutely should do a trust.
Yeah.
That might be you have property in more than one state, or you're a blended family and you want to make sure you have some measure of control on what happens after your death if your spouse is still living and remarries, or you have a business that has high value, because probate, the state charges 40 cents to every $100 of assets that go through probate. So we have a lot of, a high value business or a lot of assets going through probate. It caps at 6,000, but it can run to that. And then there's probably going to be attorney's fees and, plus the court fees and that sort of thing. So lost my train of thought on that.
I have certainly run into people who said, I don't really care what happens after I'm not here. Mm-hmm. Let them deal with it. So they don't care about it being easy for the folks who are left here at all.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's okay. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. And, because I do have clients who say exactly that, and they say it with a laugh even. It's like, I worked hard for this. They can work hard for it too. That's fine.
Yeah. Go ahead. Suffer before you get there. Is there a point or is there a situation where people just don't have enough assets, or there's no real reason to even do a will, or should everyone have a will?
There are circumstances where they don't necessarily need it. We can do a lot through titling and beneficiary designations. And so again, I'll have an initial consultation with someone and realize that, they have one child and a house. Well, we can retitle the house in various ways. We talk through it, the pros and cons of how we do it. We can make sure that they're the beneficiary of every account. They can own a vehicle joint with right of survivorship. And again, there are pros and cons to a lot of that. Most of the time, it's advantageous. If there's more than one child, it gets a little bit more complicated, or more than one beneficiary of the estate, it gets a little bit more complicated. But I would say everybody still needs planning, at least with the power of attorney, healthcare power of attorney, digital assets authorization. But we may be able to do it without a will, for sure.
Okay, very good. Mm-hmm. And let's say I am going to do a will. Mm-hmm. How do I choose, and this probably applies to healthcare power of attorney too, like how do you choose these people? How do you decide who's going to be in charge?
What you don't do is just go down your chain of kids and say, well, I'm going to do the oldest as the first and then the second one and so on. You want to think about what the roles are. So an executor, you want someone who is efficient, who can get things done in a timely manner, who is organized, who can meet deadlines. So, and who's going to be fair with the other siblings or beneficiaries, whoever is going to. For a healthcare power of attorney, you want to think about the person who is good communicating with the medical professionals, who can handle traumatic situations. And it might be a couple of people, but who can be there in the hospital, ideally with you, and communicating and taking notes and making decisions about surgeries and that sort of thing. That might be a very different personality than your oldest child, mm-hmm. or, just in the order of kids. And then your durable financial power of attorney, you want someone, again, who you trust implicitly, because they're going to have 100% access to all of your financial accounts and to be able to make decisions about how all of those are handled. And I've seen those go wrong as well, when, they've just named a kid and that kid had financial issues. And so they borrowed some money. Mm-hmm. It never got returned, or things would just disappear. Or it can also create a lot of conflict among siblings if one isn't really communicating with the other siblings. If there's already some odd family dynamics, you want to really think through, what am I creating? What kind of conflict am I creating in my family by choosing these people in the order that I'm choosing them? And maybe it needs to be somebody outside the family altogether.
Yeah. So a couple of things there. When you are choosing these people, mm-hmm. I think it's really important to discuss with your family members who you're choosing. Because it's a really sensitive subject, like feelings get hurt. feelings get hurt over you chose them versus me, that kind of thing. So trying to be really upfront and honest about it and why we're doing one thing versus another. I think sometimes people make those choices out of kindness, right? I'm going to choose this child because they're not as busy. But the child who is busy thinks that, well, you think I'm an idiot because you didn't choose me to do this. You chose the other person instead. But the other thing I want to touch on there, because you talked about people kind of borrowing money, right? I think that's one of the biggest fears I hear from people about appointing someone in the first place, in that if I fill out this paperwork and I appoint somebody, well, they're just going to take my stuff. Or they're just going to, or with the healthcare, they're just going to put me in a home, right? This, how do you bridge that gap between, the responsibility of making sure there's somebody in place to make those decisions and the fear that people have about, you know, decisions being made that they don't want or they're not ready for, things like that?
Well, I think you really just touched on it, that family conversations are hugely important. And it's also important to make some decisions without bringing the family in necessarily, because I think, you know, we worry about maybe hurting feelings, but I often will tell the clients, because they're saying that, then this isn't a decision for them. It's not a decision for the kids. And this isn't about feelings. This is about your care and how you want things managed and who you believe is the right person. Because sometimes what happens is they will go back and have these family conversations and the kids will say, do it this way. And that way isn't necessarily the right way, or the one that they spoke to says, well, just name me, you know, I'm going to take care of everything right. You know, I'm going to do it right. And if they don't truly feel that or believe that or have that comfort that's the case. So I don't know. I mean, I think sometimes family conversations are great to have, and sometimes it's not the right thing. You know, it's better to do it after the fact a little bit. And especially in, you know, I find that in deciding that who's going to get what. I've talked to some folks recently that they were really concerned about the fairness of things. And so we really had to talk through, well, you know, this is how it works and this is why we plan. This is why we think through it. And words matter in these documents that we're putting together. And how do we ensure that? So there's a lot that we can create in a plan to meet their goals. But I think you deal with that a lot with your care management company and having those family conversations. So you're probably better to speak to those family conversations than I am.
Well, I think though, what we've heard from the two of us is you're going to have to judge your own family because every family is different. Mm-hmm. Some families do need to talk about it ahead of time, and maybe others, that's not the right choice. So it's not going to be a one size fits all sort of answer.
Right.
And to your point, when there isn't anybody in your family that you want to appoint, there are people like myself who you can appoint in that instead. So we can serve as healthcare power of attorney for people. But that service really works well, like if you don't have anybody to appoint, so like a solo ager type person, or if you know that your kids aren't going to be the person you want to appoint, or your friends or neighbors, you know, sometimes people, they don't want to be a burden. They feel like if they appoint someone that they know or that's in their family to do this, that it's going to put a burden on them. And so finding an outside source to serve in that position is really appealing because they can tell us everything they want. And we go through a really detailed questionnaire with people to say, what exactly do you want in terms of care and in terms of choices, and make them answer a lot of pretty uncomfortable questions about, you know, do you want this treatment or that treatment? Probably way more in depth than when you just appoint your son or daughter and or a family member and you go, you'll know what I want.
Yeah, right. that's They often say that.
Yeah.
Oh, they know what to do. Like, do they really?
Do they?
And do they want to? Like,
yes.
Those are sometimes really hard decisions to have to make. Do they really know?
Yeah. And do you want to be the one that's put in that position to do those things? One of the biggest challenges I see is getting people to take this step, right? And sometimes just even to have the conversation, right?
Uh-huh.
So how do we bring this up, or how would you encourage people if they are the person wanting to fill out the documents? How do you bring it up to your family members? Or if you're the adult child and you have someone older and you're thinking, I really need my parents to take care of this.
Uh-huh.
How do people, like, what are your tips for those getting started conversations?
So the getting started conversations, those are two very different conversations. I think the parents having it with the kids versus the kids having it with the parents. So let's start with the kids having it with the parents. That does come up quite often, and the concern oftentimes for the kids is, I don't want to be left with a mess, and I want to understand what there is. One of the things that we do in our office before someone even sits down with me is they filled out a pretty extensive worksheet that becomes part of their estate plan, but it's what accounts are there, where are they, how are they titled, who are the beneficiaries, so that ultimately someone should be able to pick up the plan, know exactly where to go and to find all of the things. Well, that's what whoever's going to have to handle the estate administration wants. So when the kids are talking to their parents, depends on the generation, but sometimes in some of the older generations, they don't want to share that personal information that, you know, they're very, you know, close to the chest. You don't need to know these details. And so part of it is, it might be I've sat down already with the kids to go over their estate plan, and they can go back to mom and dad and say, hey, look, I sat down with Sue Hunt and we went through all of these things, and I'm trying to put my plan together, and it actually makes a difference how you have your plan set up and how I adjust mine now moving forward, and can we talk about it?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you willing, it's complimentary, are you willing to go sit down with Sue and, you know, walk through what an estate plan looks like if they haven't done anything at all?
Mm-hmm.
From the parents now talking to their now adult children, let's say, there tends to be a little bit more emotion around it, where the kids don't want to hear it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to think about their parents passing away. And it doesn't matter how old they are, right? So they can be, you know, 40 or 50 and still super emotional about, you know, their, well, let's make it older. Let's make it 60. They're worried about their 90-year-old parent. It's still very emotional. And so for the parent talking to them, it's, I'm not planning my exit. I'm just trying to be really prepared for you so that this is easy for you on the back end. You know, like I said, I use that treasure chest example. And just creating, it might be a big treasure chest and it might be a little treasure chest. but I want to make it so that you can open this up with a map and with a key, with no complication, and know exactly what to do. Mm-hmm. And so that we can eliminate conflict in the family. And that's an important thing for families to think about, is if there is conflict, and there often is.
Mm-hmm.
Is do they have an estranged sibling, or is there just, you know, some conflict between a couple of them? Then it becomes hugely important to get the right plan in place and the right people in charge so that it is easy and that there isn't a lot of conflict on the back end. And that doesn't have to be a great big giant family conversation. That has to be a very, very clear document.
Mm-hmm.
Not that hard.
Well, it's not that hard for you.
But it's not that hard. Right. If they'll sit down with me, it's not that hard. I started out as a family law attorney. You know, I you know, like you, we kind of have this therapist hat on half the time. And so it is what I do. And we talk through that. And I do it in a light enough way that we can get through those conversations, because they can be really tough conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think getting people to the table to, I always talk about framing any sort of hard conversation like this in terms of empowerment.
Right.
Right. This is not, I'm planning my exit. This is, I am taking control to make sure that what I want to have happen towards my later years happens. Right. And I make sure that I know what's going to happen after I'm gone, that who I want to get stuff and that sort of thing, that's what's going to happen. So it is taking your power. It's not right. Just planning your exit.
I saw a blurb the other day that, like, think of it like a Netflix series. You want the final episode to have a smooth plot twist, some inheritance cameos, and no cliffhangers that ruin the family vibe. I think that's brilliant.
Some inheritance cameos. Yeah. I like that. So let's assume somebody does all these documents and they've got them. Wonderful. We've put them together. Where do they put them? Where should they be kept? Who should have copies? Because this is a problem I see all the time. I will ask families, you know, have you done these things? And they'll say, yeah, okay. Where's a copy? Oh, it's in the safe somewhere, or it's, I think my so-and-so has it, that sort of thing. So this is a big red flag for me. Yeah. Where should they be keeping these documents?
I don't know if you were in the same meeting that I was in one day when we heard another attorney talk about where one was hidden, that the person did their estate plan and cut a hole out in their wall and put it in the wall and then sealed it back up. And the family couldn't find anything, right? And so they're at the house trying to get rid of personal property and doing all of the things that they're doing, and the water heater burst. And so the repair person came over and had to open up the wall, and lo and behold, there was the estate plan. That is not where to keep it.
That is not it. But my goodness, they did find it eventually.
It was probably well after the fact, but so safe deposit box is generally not what I recommend unless there's another authorized person. If I do a revocable living trust plan for someone, we'll retitle a safe deposit box into the name of the trust so that the successor trustee has immediate access to it. And it's also not as important to have the original of a trust as you do with a will that has to go through probate. So when we do them, our clients get the originals. We give them a PDF version of it as well and keep it in a client portal for them. And then we always have one too. And then we give them a little ID card to stick in their wallet. So this is a good idea for anyone that they've done their estate plan. Put something in your wallet that says, I've done my estate plan and my power of attorney and my healthcare power of attorney. And here are my emergency contacts. And here's where you can actually get at least copies of the documents. You actually need the original will, to make it easy at least, in order to go through probate. It's possible to do it with a copy, but it is really, really complicated. Mm-hmm. So putting it where someone can find it, the safe at home is all fine and good. I had another person who came in to redo their plan. I hadn't done the original one, but and they had moved, but their house was broken into. And someone walked away with the safe, which is where their estate plan was. You know, big surprise for them. They didn't get any value out of it, but they did get a good estate plan. So they had to change all of their documents at that point. And whoever did the original one was no longer in practice. So, a file cabinet is fine. It doesn't have to be. I tell clients when they ask me that question that I keep mine on a bookshelf, and I figure if the house burns down, I'm probably not going with it. Mm-hmm. And if I do, there's copies of it somewhere and they can figure it out, but I have a trust. So I'm not as worried about it because the original isn't as important.
Right. So we recently went through this with my parents who have their estate plan, and we were one of the healthcare power of attorneys was going to step down and let the successor power of attorney take over. And one of the issues was finding the original documents, which we had wisely, my parents had a copy and my brother had a copy and I had a copy, but my mom could not find her copy and I couldn't find my copy. So my brother found his copy and then we were able to do what we needed to do. And then eventually my mother and I both found our copies. So we everyone has them now, but it was that sort of, we put them in the filing cabinet and then kind of forgotten. And that is a problem if you need them in the moment, right? If something had really happened, you've got to have them accessible. So that, and I say this to people all the time, and I knew I had them in the house. I thought I knew where they were, but then when I really went to go find them, they were not where I thought they were.
Well, yeah, and think about when people go into a retirement community or assisted living or a nursing home, and now someone else has moved all of their things and reorganized it, and now where is it? And we've seen that quite a lot, that someone has relocated and they have no idea where they are, or they'll find the binder that we gave them and half of the documents aren't in there. And I had someone came in recently like that. I said, don't ever remove these from this binder. They stay here. They don't have to divide up and hide in various parts of the house. They all need to stay right here.
Don't make this a treasure hunt to try to find the documents. Yeah. But I think it behooved us, and I would advise anybody to have multiple original copies, right? Yeah. Do multiple signings so that, and make sure that the people you are appointing have copies. If you're appointing a healthcare power of attorney, give that person a copy of the document so that if anything happens and they have to step in, they have it. They're not coming to your house to dig through your filing cabinet to try to find it.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely true with the healthcare power of attorney. That's an important one. That's also why we say, you know, keep this card in your wallet, because your kid isn't going to remember where it was if you gave them a copy, and they can call us and we can get it there. Yeah. But the financial power of attorney is a different story. So I generally tell people, don't share it. I mean, maybe with your primary, which is almost always spouse, or maybe one of the kids, but most powers of attorney are effective as soon as they're signed. Mm-hmm. And so your agent has immediate authority that anyone else can rely on to handle your banking, your financial transactions, things like that. And you might change your mind down the road that you don't want it to be them. You've, you know, you've had issues. And so if you've already given it to them, you have to make sure that they've shredded it, or, you know, given it back to you, that they haven't made copies, that they're not continuing to use it, because third parties can rely on that document until you've told that third party. So all of your, you know, bankers, financial advisors, whatever, that this power of attorney has been revoked. I haven't been able to get it back. This person doesn't have authority, and you've got to jump through a lot of hoops to get them removed. So I generally say, don't share that one, but a healthcare one I think is really important, because that's, we want that pretty immediate. If there's an emergency, we want someone to be able to do things for us quickly.
That's a great point. Like I hadn't made the distinction in, share that one and don't share the other one. Mm-hmm. Hold the other one until it's actually needed. There is a little difference though. You said most of the time they work as soon as you sign them. Aren't there ones that are like springing that only start working at a certain point?
Yeah. So a springing power of attorney is one that becomes in play when a person has been either deemed incapacitated or incompetent, or they sign something at that time that says this is now active. So what I generally don't like about the springing power of attorney is that sometimes doctors won't declare someone incapacitated or incompetent, and it's needed. Someone needs to be acting and taking care of things and having access to accounts and being able to communicate with your financial advisor, because they're, you know, the person is caught up in a, you know, a romance scam online and all of their money is disappearing. So it takes a lot for someone to be deemed incapacitated or incompetent for that power of attorney to trigger. And so I prefer that, unless there are really unusual circumstances, I prefer that they're effective as soon as they're signed.
Yep, that makes good sense. So one of the things that keeps people from maybe doing all these documents and coming to see you mm-hmm. is worrying about what is this going to cost, right? Mm-hmm. What is it going to cost for me to get everything done? And so then they might go on the internet and try some legal sites and things like that. Tell us kind of what do these things cost just in general? And then also tell us about whether or not using the internet is a good idea.
Using the internet is a horrible idea.
I was just gonna let you see what you thought.
I that has come up literally probably three times in the last week that we've gone over something. Well, you know, somebody I looked online and it says this about that. Yeah, well, quit using that as your legal advice. But setting up a plan depends on a number of things. You asked me earlier, can someone have a plan and not even need a will? So it can run from a couple of $100 to, you know, $5,000 or $6,000. So it really just depends on, are we planning for two people? Are we planning for one person? This is kind of like, you know, you have to go in for surgery. It's like, well, how much is the surgery going to cost me? Like, well, the doctor's wanting to know, well, what kind of surgery are we doing? Are we doing a hangnail? Are we doing a hip replacement? Are we doing brain surgery? It's all very different. And so it really depends on what you want. And on top of that, it depends on where you go. I know that we are definitely not the most expensive in town for what we do. I know mm-hmm. we're not the cheapest, or the least expensive. Mm-hmm. But it runs all over the place. Do you want a plan that works for your family dynamics, or do you want something that's thrown together? I see wills that maybe the real estate attorney does or the criminal defense attorney does for somebody. And it's just a very basic, I'll leave everything to my spouse and then my kids, and here's what I put in charge. And there's no real plan in that. There's mm-hmm. no thought that goes into it. And so I don't know how to answer that question. And so I always laugh when somebody asks me, because it is so different depending mm-hmm. on what the circumstances are and who you choose and what it is that you want.
Well, but I think that's really important, though, for people to hear, in the sense that you can't tell people what it's going to cost or what they're going to need until you've actually had a conversation with them to uh-huh. say, okay, what are we looking at? What are we dealing with? Mm-hmm. You know, what is your particular situation? And that's good, because it means that their plan is going to be tailored to right. them rather than just some sort of general form that is very basic and doesn't really protect them the way they need to be. And I do laugh at your attorney comment, because my husband is also an attorney, and he would be the first one to tell you that he cannot do your will, because that is not his specialty. And people ask that every once in a while. They're like, oh, you're an attorney, you can do it. And he's like, no, you do not want me doing that. You want to go to an estate planning attorney mm-hmm. so that they can actually get it done right. If he does it for you, it's going to be bad. So yeah, let's not do that.
Not a good plan. Not a good plan at all.
The other thing I think is coming about more and more is people using AI to draft all kinds of documents. Right. And are you starting to see that, or have you heard anything about people using that? And is that a good idea?
It is also not a good idea. So that, and that's similar to, you know, people used LegalZoom back in the day, or the Susie Orman plan. There were all sorts of, you know, online things that you could put together. The problem with all of that is that you don't know. I mean, we've covered some of this already today. You don't know the questions to ask. Mm-hmm. You're not, when you put into ChatGPT, hey, I want to put a will together, have you told it all of the things it needs to know in order to put that together? Can it put one together? Sure. And it probably is going to look pretty okay. Is it going to work right? You know, probably not. But right. you thought, you know, if someone has a very simple situation, I'm married and I have no kids and I'm going to leave everything to my spouse and I don't care what happens to anything after I'm gone. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe use ChatGPT. I don't recommend it. Yeah. Because there's always more to that. There's always, always another question, always different family dynamics or, you know, things to think through and the what ifs. And I am the what if girl. People, my clients will laugh at me as I go through this. So, you know, we'll talk about, I want to leave it here and then here. It's like, well, yeah, but what if they're all gone? And, you know, well, what if something happens to this one? And then what's going to happen to it? How are we going to work through that? Let's talk about that next step, because those next steps really happen.
Yeah. The other thing I think about too is this is all very like state specific, right? Like what works in North Carolina is not what works in Georgia or California, other places. Uh-huh. And so you need someone who knows what is going to be legal and work with the laws where you live, not some sort of general, you know, here's an overall, you know, basic thing. You want somebody who knows the ins and outs of that state.
Right. And that makes a difference from a tax perspective. And so we still have some states that have a very low state tax exemption, meaning that you might have $1 million and anything over that is taxed at the state level. That's a lot of people. When you think about life insurance and the value of your home and what's in your bank account, that runs up really quickly. And so it does make a difference on the state. Generally with the trust, they'll pretty easily move from state to state without there being a lot of impact on it or need necessarily to get things done. There are some states, Ohio is one, Georgia is another, that have very different requirements on how their documents are executed that would not be as compliant in North Carolina. So typically, you know, I always will say, if you're moving to another state, get someone to look at it. North Carolina has some pretty strong requirements on how things are executed and the witnesses and the wording and notaries and all of that that will be applicable from state to state. And a power of attorney and healthcare directive should be able to be used in any state in which you are. However, you should still always have an attorney in your state look at things.
Yeah. One, isn't it true that some states, like in some states, like your healthcare power of attorney and your financial power of attorney have to be notarized or have to be filed with the court, and in other states they don't. And yeah, so there's all kinds of little nuances that are going to matter that you need someone with the knowledge to even tell you, hey, okay, now we've done these documents. Now you have to file it with the court or do these different things.
Well, and that brings up a really good point in that in North Carolina, we had some pretty significant changes in our power of attorney law several years ago. And so powers of attorney prior to 2018 had to be recorded in order to be used for banking, you know, pretty much anything else. And under the new statute, they don't. So do you have the old statute power of attorney or do you have the new statute power of attorney? And so yeah, again, just, you know, I always recommend that people revisit their estate plan at least every 3 years. You know, you talk to your financial advisor every year if you have one. You should at least be looking at your documents every 3 years, or if there's any major life change, because that can significantly change what needs to be in your documents and how things are handled.
Yeah.
And we do an automatic review process, and we remind our clients every year, okay, it's been a year, you know, what changes have occurred, but every 3 years they can go through a review process because it's important. You know, most people will stick this in a drawer and say, great, I got this done. I can check this off. And, you know, you get grandkids down the road or you lose a family member, something happens. And, you know, they're the people that you named in your power of attorney. Those things need they are living documents. They need to continue shifting and moving with you.
Right. They're not, it's not a one-time conversation. Uh-huh. It's not a, okay, now I've done this, check.
Right.
You have to keep revisiting it because the people you appointed, their lives are going to change.
Right.
And then your life is going to change. Right. You know, the things you thought you wanted today may not be what you want 3 years from now.
And your kids grow up. And then you realize, you know, when you said, hey, I think they could handle all of the money at 35. Now you say, maybe it's 65. Maybe, you know, or maybe it's 25.
Yes. Yes. Maybe I've changed my mind about that. So a lot of people, when they are doing estate planning, they are thinking about how to protect assets so that they don't end up having to spend everything if they are to go into a nursing home or assisted living, things like that. What advice or guidance do you give people if they are trying to make plans to try to protect things, or they're worried about losing their home, those kinds of things?
So I don't specifically do Medicaid planning, and yet we still have these conversations all the time. So that's a whole interesting animal in itself. However, the conversation that often comes up is, well, I don't want the nursing home to get everything. And then I will kindly say that the nursing home isn't taking anything. You are paying for your care to live somewhere and have your housing and your food and your utilities and medical care and, you know, 24/7 someone there available for you, and you're just paying for it. Well, I don't, you know, I want my family to keep my house. Well, I can always, almost always, do things to protect the family home. And that might be through titling differently. It usually is. It could be through irrevocable trust planning. There are, there is in North Carolina a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust, so that you can move all of your assets into that. It means you don't control them anymore. So you put someone else that you trust in charge of that for you, and you can live in your home and that sort of thing. And that's really a good tool if there's a, I think, a fine window, or, you know, a limited window that that is beneficial for. So if people have plenty of money and it's a married couple and they have enough to cover their care, they should pay for their care. Medicaid is for people who don't have assets, who can't afford to go into assisted living or, well, into a nursing home, not even assisted living. So it's for people who don't have the means to pay for it. Someone can create the means by giving up their assets, and there's a 5-year look back on that. So that window that I was talking about is sometimes one spouse is having to go into a nursing home, and the one who isn't doesn't want to have to spend down to, you know, whatever it is now, $160,000, and they can keep the house and keep the car and keep some stuff. They want to make sure that they have all of these other, all of the rest of their money to support them. And so there are different tools that can be used that oftentimes I'll send them to you all for the Medicaid, at least the Medicaid application piece of it. But there are different tools that they can use. There are annuities, Medicaid annuities. Like I said, there's the trust, there's retitling real estate. So there are a lot of different things. And that's one thing that I always encourage my clients to remember, is that this isn't a one and done when we're doing your foundational plan. It might be that down the road you need to look at some things a little bit more thoroughly, if, especially if one of you gets an early diagnosis of dementia and your assets aren't enough to, you know, if somebody's getting diagnosed at 65 years old and is probably going to live for another 25, 30 years. In a nursing home, well, the assets will be gone. How do we protect that? And that's when those Medicaid trusts are brilliant.
So according to surveys, 76% of Americans know that doing wills are important. And yet only 27% of us actually have one in place. How do we bridge the gap between knowing it's important and actually getting it done?
And I love this question. So to me, that's like the million-dollar estate planning question. People don't fail to create wills because they don't know they should. They fail because they get caught in this intersection of psychology, mortality, family dynamics, and just general procrastination. And so the things that I see most often are they think that it's just about death, so they think it's really morbid, so they don't want to talk about it. But estate planning, like we've talked about, is so much more. It's your healthcare. It's who's taking care of you while you're living. That's estate planning to me. I don't care. I mean, I do care what happens to my stuff after I'm gone. But while I'm living is what's most important to me, for me. A lot of people know they need to do it, but now is not the time. It's not important right now. I'm going to live a long time. So for them, time is the factor. Mm-hmm. But we've seen time and time again that we don't know when we're going to go. We don't know what crazy crisis is going to happen. So time. They assume it's too complicated or too expensive. And that's not true, number one. It could be fairly inexpensive for someone to get something done. It can be more expensive. It depends on what they're doing. It doesn't have to be complicated. And we try to really simplify this process by asking questions and giving them documents, things to think about, and really thinking through family dynamics. And then there's family dynamics. So family mm-hmm. conversations are hard. People get emotional about it. And they, are embarrassed to talk sometimes about the estrangement of certain kids. And mm-hmm. And that's really common. That's, I think, one thing that I think is really important for people to understand is that it is really not unusual to have an estranged family member. And I hear it over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And then finally, they just don't feel the consequences. And a lot of times people aren't moved to do something unless, unless they see the risk or see the danger or that something has already happened. And I think that is more often the case, that they lost a family member and they had to go through probate and thought, I don't want to put my kids through this. Or mm-hmm. their parent has dementia and they're trying to do things for them and they don't have the power of attorney to do it. And they realize, oh, I don't want to leave this scenario for my family. So the bridging the gap is exactly what we're doing right now. It's educating the community. It's trying to make people understand that estate planning isn't about, it is, about planning what's going to happen with your things after your death, but it's not planning for death. It's planning right. for your life and for your family and the people that you care about. And so reframing it from that, this is an act of protection and control. And, how can we simplify this process and this step and talk through the life events and why this is important so that you want to move forward with it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's that empowerment piece again. Right. I'm going to take the power. Mm-hmm. And we see that all the time in care management too, where an adult child has kind of gone through this caregiving journey with their own parent. And then that is the thing that has motivated them to even sit down with us and say, okay, I want to lay out, I want to go here and I'm going to make my, I'm going to get on the wait list now. And because right. I don't ever want to put my kids through what I've just been through mm-hmm. with my own parents. So yeah, it's sad that it takes that sometimes, mm-hmm. but it's really motivational to people when they've been through it.
Well, I think it's, I've had a couple of scenarios recently where there has been an early diagnosis of dementia. And what I love is that they're so proactive in mm-hmm. moving forward and making sure the plan is in place and that it's going to work for both of them. And what protections can we do today versus the one who came in where the spouse had already reached the point where she couldn't even execute a power of attorney. And there's, right. It's not a, it's, you can be in not great shape and still be able to do one, but you can't be, you have to know who you are and what you have and who your yeah. spouse is and who your kids are. And so that difference is just so crucial that, I think that kind of bridges the gap a little bit of understanding why it's important to plan. Yeah. You don't want to be in that situation where your hands are tied and you can't do anything.
Yeah. And what happens in that situation is people end up having to pursue guardianship mm-hmm. of their loved one. And guardianship is a court process
right.
where you have to go in and basically, testify that your loved one is incompetent mm-hmm. and they have to be declared incompetent. And that in and of itself is an emotional mm-hmm. thing too. Right. Families don't want to have to do that. And but that's the position they end up in if they haven't done their powers of attorney before that. Right. The other thing about guardianship is now the court's involved, and you have to file reports with the court saying, showing that you're taking care of the person and that you're handling all their finances appropriately, all of which can be avoided if you just have the health care and financial power of attorney. So it's so much simpler.
Right. And it might not be a family member that gets appointed as the guardian. Yeah. It might be an attorney. And now they're getting paid for it as well, too. And so the money starts trickling out as well. So, yeah.
That's exactly right.
You want to control. I would think you want to control who's going to manage things for you, not have potentially some stranger or some judge deciding who it's going to be. Might not be the person you want.
That's a great point. I think a lot of families assume that, right, if they need to go pursue guardianship of mom or dad, that it's going to be a family member who will be appointed. And sometimes it is, but the court has the ability to appoint anybody they want. And it may be the person you think is best, but it may not be. Right. It can be anybody. Yeah.
And if the family is in disagreement about who it's going to be, it probably is going to be someone else.
It will be somebody else. A lot of my guardianship clients are just that. It's because the family can't get along. Yeah. And so that's why we're involved. Yep.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So, Sue, is there anything else you feel like we've missed or that you want to share as kind of a take-home message for our audience today?
I think the take-home message is that planning now is crucially important. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I've seen it in my own family time and time again. You know, I lost my mom when I was 8 years old, and there was nothing good in place. And we ended up with my dad, who probably shouldn't have gotten us. And so things happen. I mean, her death was unexpected, and they weren't together at the time. So our lives were upside down. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So planning now, having family conversations, thinking through the family dynamics. Don't think that this is just about death and dying. This is about protecting and empowerment and choice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the most important thing, is the estate planning is about choice. Yeah. You want to choose.
Wonderful. And now, where can people find you if they want to get in touch after our conversation today?
Excellent. So our company is called Focus Estate Solutions. And so we have a website, focusestatesolutions.com. They can call us. They can go to the website. All of our information is there. And we always welcome new clients anywhere in North Carolina. We can meet virtually or in person. We love people in person, but virtual works as well.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Corinne. This was a lot of fun.